I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country.
Well, good, because we don't want you in our country. You jerk. Get out.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
If he's still here.
And I'm wondering how I get down the stairs.
Just get out.
Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am. Stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Desi Doyen, you just before airtime, you play. I hadn't heard this clip. I had seen the headlines of it. It seemed kind of weird, the headlines that I saw.
Yes.
Like, this couldn't really be possible. But, yes. You know, with Donald Trump, I guess anything is possible, right?
Yep.
So this was about Tim Walz yesterday.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. It was in that bonkers cabinet meeting where they said all kinds of unhinged stuff.
And
yes, it was Trump was
asked specifically about Tim Walz.
Yep. I think the man's a grossly incompetent man. I thought that from the day I watched J.D. destroy him in the debate, I was saying, who was more incompetent, that man or my man? I had a man and he had a man. They were both incompetent.
So did he just say that J.D. Vance was incompetent, that his man, J.D. Vance, was incompetent?
Why, yes, he did.
Good Lord. That man is just out of his mind.
Verbal diarrhea.
Yeah, no kidding. There was some other verbal diarrhea from that man that we'll get to a little bit later. Don't worry, I won't play much of the sound. You heard a little bit of it at the top of the show there. Some obnoxious, racist idiocy from the president of the United States directed to folks, actually a lot of folks in our listening area. So we will get to that in a bit. But as usual, we got a lot to get to today, including Desi Doyen's latest Green News report, which, thanks to a fascinating and longer than anticipated interview yesterday with Carrie A. Lee, formerly of the U.S. Army War College, on Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth's murder and U.S. war crime spree in the Caribbean yesterday. Well, we had to push off Desi Doyen's Green News report.
Yes,
sorry,
we did.
Sorry again about that.
No worries.
But we will definitely get to that today, one way or another, I think. Anyway, I'm delighted to start today with actually a few election stories as America readies itself in 2026 to use the ballot box to take on the degenerate autocratic oligarchy that believes they have taken over our nation, headed up by that jerk in the Oval Office. As discussed earlier this week, there was a special election for the U.S. House in a very, very red GOP gerrymandered district in Tennessee's 7th congressional district between military vet and stalwart Trump Republican Matt Van Epps and unapologetically progressive Democratic former community organizer turned state rep Afton Bain, with about 99% of the vote now said to have been counted by computer tally as of Wednesday morning. None of it, of course, yet verified by human beings, but with no major reports to my knowledge of problems for voters at the polls on Tuesday, the Republican Van Epps appears to have won almost 54% of the vote to the Democrat Bain's 45%. There were about four other independents in the race that basically split up the rest of the percent or two. But that appears to be a pretty healthy 9-point or so margin of victory for the Republican in Tennessee in what is the last U.S. House special election of the year as we officially head into the 2026 midterm cycle, with Republicans holding a razor-thin three-vote or so margin in the U.S. House. But that nine-point victory for Republicans on Tuesday in Tennessee sort of masks what really should have been a rout for the Republicans in this highly gerrymandered district that was drawn after the 2020 census. It's a district that once represented most of the very Democratic-leaning Nashville area in Davidson County, but that after cracking Nashville up into three different districts by this GOP gerrymander, well, it now stretches across 14 different counties, representing a small swath of blue-leaning urban area in Nashville, along with red-leaning suburbs and very ruby-red rural areas. Last year, the district went to Donald Trump by 22 points and to Republican congressman there, Mark Green, by 21 points. Green retired over the summer to take a job in the private sector, and so we have an empty seat. That's what the special election was for this week on Tuesday. Both parties threw a ton of money into this one, to this one special House election, seeing it as a likely bellwether for next year. But it's a district that Republicans should not have had to spend millions of dollars in order to win. And yet they did. They knew they needed to, frankly. It was they shouldn't have. It was manufactured to be an easy district for Republicans to hold on to. They did hold it, but it wasn't easy, especially with a Democratic candidate who was not one of these sort of moderate, milquetoast Southern Democrats. No, she was an unapologetically progressive candidate previously labeled as the AOC of Tennessee, a moniker that she, Afton Bain, actually embraced. She did not run from it. She even campaigned with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the closing weeks of the campaign, while Trump tossed his support behind Matt Van Epps, but only at a distance, making a remote appearance only by phone during a closing week rally for fear that, you know, showing up in person would have, there's a lot of people who really don't like Donald Trump and would also have nationalized the race even further against the Republican. GOP super PACs backing Van Epps painted Bain as a radical in attack ads against her, pointed to her past support of defunding the police, which she declined to distance herself from. So she was not running, like I say, as a moderate Democrat. She was all out progressive, basically. I had a phrase that I can't use on radio. anyway, that tactic did not seem... That attack on her as some sort of radical liberal, it did not seem to work. Sure, yes, Van Epps did win, but in a district that Trump won by 22 points last year, while a win is a win, but it was a 13-point shift in favor of the Democratic candidate in a ruby-red district. Engineered, in fact, to eliminate even a chance of a Democrat being able to win the seat. And that is a message that is being felt far and wide by Republicans today, I promise you. And if Republicans want to argue, as they have in several special elections where they lost this year, that the Democrats only did so well, you know, because it was a low turnout special election. Well, this was not a low turnout election. As of Tuesday, it was a special election, but it was not low turnout. As of Tuesday, almost 180,000 votes were tallied in the last midterm elections in this district back in 2022 when the Republican candidate won by 22 points. Just 180,822 votes were tallied. So, you know, less than 1,000 more than we had already counted as of Tuesday. When everything else is tallied up, there may have been even more votes cast in Tuesday's special election than in the 2022 midterm in this district. So I know Republicans have been arguing all year in these special elections, oh, they're low turnout affairs. Of course, those always help Democrats.
Yes.
Not the case here.
No. In this special election with turnout almost equaling the November 2024 election?
22.
November 2022 election. That's amazing.
The last midterm elections. And it may outpace it. Moreover, I should also note, as mentioned, there are parts or all of 14 counties in the very red 7th Congressional District in Tennessee, and every single one of them, all 14, saw the vote increase toward the Democratic candidate as compared to last year. Every single one, all 14 counties, from the reddest tiny rural Wayne County, which saw Democrats increase the vote share there by almost 7%, to the bluest county, Davidson County, which is Nashville, where Democratic turnout increased in the already very Democratic city by 20 points. Democratic vote share, I should say, not necessarily turnout, but it increased by 20 points over the presidential results last year. Still, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, whose job is apparently to lie about everything, and on that aspect of his job, by the way, I should say he's very, very good. Johnson suggested on Wednesday that he was not concerned at all about next year's midterm elections. He predicted that Republicans would actually pick up seats next year. Okay. And he cited the special election in Tennessee on Tuesday as evidence. Quote, "This doesn't concern me at all," Johnson said. "Democrats put millions of dollars in. They were really trying to set the scenario that there's some sort of wave going on. There is not," he said. "We just proved there is not." Okay. Maybe he'll be right, but good luck with that. I don't think they proved anything on Tuesday about how good Republicans are going to do next year in gerrymandering so many GOP states to make it harder for Democrats to win after the 2020 census. It was done at the cost of making safe Republican seats in a whole bunch of states a little bit less safe. Tuesday's result in Tennessee's 7th, with Democrats picking up 13 points over their performance just 1 year ago in 2024, well, that is actually pretty typical of the Democratic performances we have seen all year in all U.S. House special elections so far this year, not to mention in regular elections as well over the past year. The shift from red to blue in 2025, U.S. House special elections has averaged about 13 points, exactly what we saw on Tuesday. Voters moving towards the Democrats by 13 points compared to the margins from the 2024 general elections in the same districts. So what might that actually mean next year, no matter how Mike Johnson is trying to paint it today? If the shift toward Democrats is anywhere near similar to what we saw on Tuesday and that we have seen over the past year, in a House where Republicans currently hold a razor-thin three-vote advantage? Well, I did some mathing on all of this. In the 2024 U.S. House elections, 28 Republicans won their races by 10 percentage points or less. 28. So if the electorate shifts just 10 points or more next year toward the Democrats next year, those 28 Republicans will be out of a job, and Democrats will take over a pretty healthy majority in Congress's lower chamber under, by the way, new House Speaker Hakeem Jeffries, presumably. But of course, while flipping 28 seats would be a rout next year, perhaps even considered a blue wave, let's, of course, not forget about the Trump GOP mid-decade gerrymandering that has been underway over the past several months since Trump bullied Texas lawmakers into kicking it off by rewriting their House maps to try and remove five minority Democratic seats from voters, trying to, as you know, Republicans apparently find it easier to steal seats from voters rather than offer policies that those voters might like.
Yes, and you can see why they do it. It works. They broke up Nashville and they won.
Yep. As you know, also, that move was countered by voters. The move in Texas was countered by voters in Texas, by voters in California. We voted last month to rewrite our own maps to flip 5 red seats to blue ones next year. And it was the voters out here, not the lawmakers, doing it. And Virginia is trying to do something similar to put that on the ballot next year for voters in Virginia to perhaps flip 3 more Republican seats to blue in response. But a number of other Republican states are rewriting maps to flip a seat or two here or there, even as legal challenges are underway pretty much against all of these mid-decade redistricting things that are being done. In the end, all of that could end up being largely a wash, really, for both parties. It could even turn out to be a slight advantage for Democrats, particularly since the rewritten maps for more red districts comes at the expense, as I said, of larger margins for Republicans in what would normally be considered safe districts, at least in a year when Republicans we're not staring down the barrel of potentially, 13-point shifts in towards the Democrats in virtually every district, as we have seen this year, in both blue and deep red areas alike. So those 28 Republican seats won in 2024 by 10 points or less, those could very much be in play next year, as Mike Johnson well knows, whether he's willing to admit it out loud or not. Still, as you also likely know, the corrupt activist Republican Supreme Court majority is considering knocking out the last leg holding up the landmark Voting Rights Act regarding racial gerrymanders, and according to most experts, they are likely to do so. The only real question seems to be whether they will do it in time for next year's midterms or not. For example, whether they'll do it right after the first of the year or whether they'll wait until the end of their term in late June or early July next year after many House primaries have already happened and it would be too late to rewrite most, if not all, of the maps. So if it happens in January, if the Supreme Court comes out with this ruling as expected, you will see a mad scramble of dozens at least a dozen or more, I should say, Republican states redrawing their House maps in order to racially gerrymander many blue districts right out of existence next year. So that pickup of that I describe of potentially 28 seats where Republicans won by 10 points or less last year, that may or may not be enough for Democrats to win back a majority if the Republicans are allowed to rewrite 12 or more seats based on this Supreme Court ruling that we're all expecting. But ultimately, this will all come down to voters because there is a very steep curve on the math here. While voters have shifted an average, as I said, of 13 points toward Democrats this year, and a 10-point shift next year would, at least as of now, mean a pickup of about 28 seats in the House. If the average shift next year towards Democrats is, instead of 10 points, it's just 12 points, which would still be less than the average we saw this year, well, there are 64 Republicans currently in the U.S. House who won by 12 points or less last year.
Wow.
64 seats, yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, there are 92 Republicans who won by just 15 points or less last year. So when the GOP starts jiggering out these districts in new House maps, well, a district that was once wildly safe with a 15-point advantage suddenly becomes much less so if you take a point or three of Republican voters out of that district, or if you add a point or three of Democratic voters into it. So I'm just doing math here. The voting part will be up to you and all of us, and the fighting to make sure that all of those votes are both cast and counted will also be up to all of us. But for Republicans willing to tell the truth about what happened in Tennessee's 7th Congressional District on Tuesday, well, they are, or they should be, very worried. Quote, this is one of the biggest flashing red light warning signs we have seen yet for Republicans, said Republican strategist Matt Whitlock in a post on social media, adding, if every House district in the country shifted left by this same amount, we would be looking at a blue wave far worse than 2018, he said.
Wow.
Now, in 2018, 41 seats flipped from red to blue in response to the first half of Donald Trump's first term. Whitlock is now estimating about 43 seats could be flipped next year. That's a Republican strategist saying 43 Republican seats could be lost next year. A number of election watchers are now suggesting that these numbers suggest that even a U.S. Senate majority could now be in play for Democrats next year, despite a difficult map that they must defend next year. So let's not get ahead of ourselves. And all of this ahead of January 1, by the way, when health insurance rates are set to skyrocket for millions of Americans, including a majority of them in states and House districts controlled by Republicans, who are still refusing to roll back the enormous cuts that they made to health care, to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, to Medicaid, to Medicare, that all begin next year. But anyway, as I said, let's not get ahead of ourselves. We will see. Never underestimate, you know, the Democrats' ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory between now and then.
True.
But that is the math just as of today. No matter how you may hear Republicans trying to spin things as the year wraps up and as the midterm elections begin to kick into high gear. There was also a few other elections, by the way, on Tuesday. One of note was in the battleground state of Georgia, which went for Donald Trump in 2016, barely. It went for Joe Biden in 2020, barely. And then it went for Trump again in 2024, barely. So it's another state that folks will obviously be watching closely in the new year. And here, the Democrat in the race did not just pick up votes compared to last year, but she easily unseated a Republican incumbent. A former Democratic state rep has won the race to be the next mayor of Roswell, Georgia, ousting an opponent who had the backing of the Republican state governor. Now, Roswell is a very affluent, formerly very conservative, upper middle class enclave just outside of Atlanta. And it is the ninth most populous city in the state. They had a runoff on Tuesday, and Mary Robichaux, a former Democratic member of the Georgia House of Representatives, reportedly won that election on Tuesday with about 53% of the vote, beating the incumbent Republican mayor, Republican-supported mayor Kurt Wilson, who garnered about 47% of the vote. As Newsweek notes in its coverage, while the mayoral election in Roswell was supposedly a nonpartisan race, Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp called on state voters to back Wilson in the race. He called him a Republican mayor who had kept his city, quote, safe and thriving, while Robichaux, the Democrat, she served in Georgia's House as a Democratic state rep from 2019 to 2023. So it's, you know, they say it's not really partisan, but it's part of everybody knows who is backing who and so forth. So
yeah,
the politics,
they ain't fooling anybody.
Well, the politics are pretty clear,
yeah.
Especially in a runoff where neither candidate secured a majority in the general election back on November 4 when Democrats outright won damn near everything everywhere across the country. In the previous election in November, just 185 votes separated Wilson and Robichaux, forcing Tuesday's runoff. But on Tuesday, she easily defeated the incumbent Republican mayor in a city where Republican-backed mayors have held the mayor's office for almost 30 continuous years. I had to go back to 1997 in order to find the last Democratic mayor of Roswell, Georgia. Well, that's a switch. Speaking to Newsweek, Thomas Gift of the Center on U.S. Politics at the University College London said, quote, almost all politics in America at this point has been nationalized. So it would be a mistake to view this race as a purely local issue. Even in officially nonpartisan contests, he added, voters often read the candidates through a national partisan lens, and high-profile endorsements reinforce that dynamic. That was certainly the case here with potential future Republican presidential contender, Governor Brian Kemp, going all in for the incumbent mayor here in Roswell. But it did not work, at least not in Roswell, for the first time in almost 30 years. So keep up the good work, voters. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with the battle now being fought on the ground to protect both non-citizens and citizens alike as Trump's attempted federal thug crackdown spread to a few more Democratic-leaning cities where we've got both of them a lot of listeners. That and Desi Doyen's latest Green News report, I swear.
Finally.
I think. Is all still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
This is where the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics for you.
Wonder how many of our listeners had to listen to their racist relatives over the Thanksgiving break.
Oh, my, yes.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. All right, this is a story that actually broke before our Thanksgiving break and your racist relatives' meal with them over. This was actually from a week or two ago. A federal judge dismissed a Trump administration legal challenge to New York State policies that block immigration officials from arresting people at state courthouses, saying that the federal government can't force states to cooperate with those enforcement efforts. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge Mae D'Agostino granted New York Attorney General Letitia James's motion to dismiss the government's lawsuit, one of several legal actions by the Republican administration targeting state and local policies over immigration enforcement. State and local policies that Republicans otherwise, you know, they used to love to defend the right of states' rights, small government, all of that. They're in favor of states' rights and small government, at least when a Democrat is in the White House.
True.
Anyway, the Trump administration's failed federal lawsuit here challenged a 2020 state law banning federal immigration officers from arresting people who are coming and going from New York courthouses or who are in court for proceedings unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. Oh, so you mean all they would need to do to follow the law is get a legal warrant to make the arrest that they want to make from a judge? Sounds very onerous, doesn't it? No wonder they sued, I guess. I mean, why should they have to follow the law in the state in which they're operating? The Trump administration thinks that they are the law. In fact, they still are not the law, at least when it comes to local and state laws like this, at least not yet anyway. The state law called the Protect Our Courts Act was approved in response to enforcement actions at courthouses during Donald Trump's first term in office. The law does not cover federal immigration courts. So this requires a judge's warrant for a federal arrest at a at state courts coming and going too. But even that was, you know, it doesn't affect federal immigration courts, but even that was just asking too much for this authoritarian wannabe dictator, I guess. In his lawsuit, the Department of Justice claimed that the New York law and two related state executive orders were unconstitutional because they obstructed the execution of federal immigration authorities. Judge D'Agostino, though, found that New York's decision not to participate in enforcing federal civil immigration law is protected by the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, which sets boundaries on the federal government's powers. Quote, fundamentally, the U.S. fails to identify any federal law mandating that state and local officials generally assist or cooperate with federal immigration enforcement efforts. Nor could it, the judge wrote. No such federal laws exist. Because the 10th Amendment, she said, prohibits Congress from conscripting state and local officials and resources to assist with federal regulatory schemes like immigration enforcement. So this is, you know, one of those sanctuary policies that Republicans try to pretend is somehow unlawful, is in violation of the Constitution, steps on federal powers or some such nonsense. Here you got a federal judge upholding this sanctuary state law, essentially saying, yeah, they have no right to, feds have no right to come in and step on the state's toes in this manner.
And upholding it on a constitutional basis,
correct,
as a violation of the 10th Amendment.
Yep. A Justice Department spokesman said in response that President Trump's immigration enforcement agenda is a top national security and public safety priority that this Department of Justice will continue to vigorously defend whenever challenged in court. But if, in fact, you actually want public safety, then you should be in favor of making sure that people do not stay away from the court system for, you know, fear of that you don't scare them off from coming in to court, whether it's to the court or police station, in order to report a crime. And that's why these so-called sanctuary laws exist in the first place. It's a public safety issue. It improves public safety. Also, by the way, remember, immigration violations are not criminal matters. Kind of know that's hard to, you know, keep in mind with all of this, you know, these jerks playing military tough guy. Border Patrol and ICE coming into these states and cities around the country and acting like they're in the middle of a war. But these aren't even criminal matters. These are civil matters. Despite these tough guy U.S. military style raids that these man boys in the Trump administration are carrying out, New York Attorney General Letitia James, whose office argued for the lawsuit, the federal lawsuit, to be dismissed, and who, by the way, over the holidays also saw her own indictment against her for supposed mortgage fraud tossed out by a federal judge. She said that she was fighting for the, quote, dignity and rights of immigrant communities. Well, thank you, Ms. James. Quote, everyone deserves to seek justice without fear, she said in a statement. This ruling ensures that anyone can use New York's state courts without being targeted by federal authorities. Well, good. Now, that ruling is also one that the Trump administration may wish to pay attention to or just continue to ignore because they don't give a damn about the law, as they announced plans this week to carry out a similar attempted authoritarian crackdown on supposedly on immigrants in New Orleans, where we have listeners on WHIV, and in Minnesota, specifically in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where we've got a lot of folks who listen to this program on AM 950 out there, KTNF, and where I want folks to know, there in Minneapolis, St. Paul, that yes, the nation is watching. The nation has your back. After Trump rolled out some particularly disgusting rhetoric at the White House on Tuesday, which seems to focus specifically on Minnesota, specifically on Minneapolis. We played a little bit about a little bit of his comments at the top of the show about Governor Walz. But as AP reported, federal authorities are now preparing a targeted immigration enforcement operation. Seems like they should put quotes around the word targeted, but a targeted immigration enforcement operation in Minnesota that would primarily focus on Somali immigrants. That, according to a person familiar with the planning. The move comes as Trump, again on Tuesday, escalated his obnoxious racist rhetoric about Minnesota's sizable Somali community, saying that he did not want immigrants from the East African country, the war-torn East African country, he didn't want them in the U.S. at all because, quote, they contribute nothing, unquote. He claimed that residents of the war-ravaged African nation are too reliant on U.S. social safety net and add little to the United States. Trump's contemptuous description of the entire immigrant community is just the latest example of him attacking the Somali diaspora across the U.S. Somalis have been coming to Minnesota and to other states, often as refugees. Since the 1990s, the president has made no distinction in his obnoxious remarks during a cabinet meeting on Tuesday or any other time between citizens and non-citizens. He just hates them all. I wonder why. The president's comments came days after his administration announced that it is halting all asylum decisions following the shooting of two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C. Two National Guard soldiers, by the way, who would not have been shot were it not for their deployment into D.C. by Donald Trump. The suspect in last week's incident is originally from Afghanistan. So naturally, let's stop asylum for everyone. Yeah. He was granted asylum, in fact, by the Trump administration. But Trump has used the moment to raise question about immigrants from anywhere, well, at least from non-white, non-European nations, including Somalia. Quote, they contribute nothing. I don't want them in our country, Trump told reporters near the end of the televised pretend cabinet meeting on Tuesday, much of which Trump, by the way, was seen napping through. He added, quote, their country is no good for a reason. Really, Donnie? What is that reason? Why don't you go ahead and say it? He went on to say, quote, your country stinks and we don't want them in our country. Trump for years has criticized Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, a Minnesota Democrat who emigrated from Somalia in 1995 as a child. Trump, using a few old favorite racist phrases, vowed last week in a social media post to send Somalis, quote, back to where they came from. An alleged Minnesota, home to the largest Somali community in the United States, is, quote, a hub of fraudulent money laundering activity. And if anybody knows anything about money laundering, well, that would be Donald Trump. On Tuesday, he said again that Somalis in the U.S. should, quote, go back to where they came from and fix it. He specifically pledged to terminate temporary legal protections for Somalis living in Minnesota, a move that is triggering fear in the state's deeply rooted immigrant community, along with doubts about whether the White House has the legal authority to enact that directive as described. In case you're wondering, no, he doesn't have that authority, but as you know, that won't necessarily keep him from trying to do it anyway. The announcement drew immediate pushback from state leaders and immigration experts who characterized his declaration as a legally dubious effort to sow suspicion toward Minnesota's Somali community. In theory, the move would only directly affect a tiny fraction of tens of thousands of Somalis living in Minnesota. A report produced for Congress in August put the number of Somalis covered by that temporary protected status, or TPS, at just 750 nationwide. So we're talking about a very few folks who would be targeted by this. Trump also renewed his criticism of Congresswoman Omar, whose family fled the civil war in Somalia. She spent several years in a refugee camp in Kenya before eventually coming to the U.S. He said, quote, and don't worry, I'm not going to play his disgusting voice, but you should know what he said. He said, quote, "We can go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country," Trump said. Ilhan Omar, he said, is garbage, repeating, she's garbage. Her friends are garbage. Hell of a guy. On Tuesday, Omar punched back at Trump on social media saying, quote, "His obsession with me is creepy. I hope he gets the help he desperately needs." And he does desperately need help. This is, I got to tell you, this is one of those few days when I really wish I was not on FCC radio to respond to this. Anyway, he added about Somali immigrants, quote, "These aren't people that work. These are people that do nothing but complain." Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said, Trump's message, quote, wrong, and said Somali immigrants have helped improve his community. Quote, "They have started businesses and created jobs. They've added to the cultural fabric of what Minneapolis is," he said. To, again, villainize an entire group is ridiculous under any circumstances, and the way Donald Trump is consistent in doing it, I think, calls into question major constitutional violations, and it certainly violates the moral fabric of what we stand by in this country as Americans, the mayor said. But I will say on the upside, these remarks by Trump give a sort of a whole bunch of fodder, legal fodder, to those who will challenge Trump's ICE thugs coming into Minneapolis and rounding up Somalis, making it very easy to show that this is, in fact, an unlawful, targeted, racist roundup. The enforcement operation could begin in the coming days, according to AP and others, and is expected to focus on the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Teams of immigration agents would spread across the Twin Cities in what the person described as a directed high-priority sweep, whatever the hell they think that means. An estimated 260,000 people of Somalian descent were living in the U.S. as of 2024. According to the Census Bureau, the largest population is in the Minneapolis area, home of about 84,000 residents, the vast majority of whom, by the way, are American citizens. Keep that in mind when the roundups begin, or at least when they attempt to begin them. Minneapolis Mayor Frey vowed that the city's police officers, many of whom are Somalis themselves, will not work with any federal agents doing immigration enforcement, saying it's not their job. And as the federal judge in New York ruled just before Thanksgiving, he's right. It is not their job. Quote, "Targeting Somali people means that due process will be violated," Frey said, adding, and let's be clear, it means that American citizens will be detained for no other reason than the fact that they look like they are Somali. That is not now and will never be a legitimate reason, he said. Trump and other officials in the administration have used increasingly harsh language in recent days against Somalis living in the U.S. after a right-wing news outlet claimed that taxpayer dollars from defrauded government programs were flowing to the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, a terrorist affiliate of Al-Qaeda that holds parts of rural Somalia. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who last week a sick and twisted Trump described as retarded in a social media post, throwing out accusations, and let's be very clear, demonizing an entire population and lying to people about the safety and security of this state is beneath that, said Walz about those comments from Trump. Jelani Hussein, a Somali-American who is executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, said around 95% of Somalis in Minnesota are U.S. citizens, 95% of them. He estimated that 50% of the community was actually born here. Although I know that Donald Trump doesn't recognize anyone who was born here if their parents were not both American citizens, because he doesn't recognize the Constitution itself as being valid.
Yeah.
Minneapolis City Council member Jamal Osman, who is Somali-American, promised that the city will stand up for its immigrants, saying, quote, "Our community has lived through fear in the past, and we are not going to let it divide us." The police chief in Minneapolis, Brian O'Hara, also told folks in the community on Tuesday that they would not, the police would not be assisting Trump's federal thugs beyond what was required by law. And again, there was a very good reason for doing so, according to Chief O'Hara.
And from a public safety perspective, the fear of people to cause the police is something that harm, to call the police in a time of need is something that harms everyone. We don't need that. If people are able to prey on certain people in our community, to victimize them, to rob them, because they think those folks are less likely to call the police, that makes everyone in the city less safe. It does absolutely nothing for public safety. So I just need to be clear, as our mayor has stated, the Minneapolis Police Department does not work with federal law enforcement for the purpose of conducting immigration enforcement. We don't provide information to federal immigration authorities. We don't ask people about their immigration status. Our mission is clear: to protect life, to uphold the law, and to maintain safety for all people in our communities.
That was Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara assuring residents of the community that law enforcement, the police, the local police anyway, have got their backs during whatever may be coming in the days ahead from Trump's federal jackbooted thugs. So I just want to let you know, we see you, Minneapolis, St. Paul. We've got your back as much as we can. Stay strong there. And by the way, in New Orleans, our listeners down there, 102.3 WHIV. And up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950, KTNF. We are watching. You are not alone.
And we're watching everywhere around the country where the federal government, the Trump administration, is using these immigration raids to terrorize local communities.
Yep. All right. And by the way, if anyone down there, whether down in New Orleans or in Minnesota, wants to reach out with information about what you are seeing, I would always love to hear from you via email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And if you want to reach me via more secure encrypted mail, you can also reach out to me. I'm available via Proton Mail at bradblog@protonmail.com. All right, quick break. And we are, in fact, back with Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. The Bradcast survives thanks to you and your support. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us continue to do over your public airwaves what we try to do 5 days a week. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thank you. Okay, a day late and a dollar short. We're always a dollar short on this show, but a day late and dollar short. I want to get right to it because I got a question I want to ask you about afterwards. Our latest Green News Report.
Landslides have ravaged everything in their path, claiming hundreds of lives.
Death toll climbs in Southeast Asia after simultaneous typhoons. While you were on holiday, the Trump administration got busy bringing back dirty air and contaminated water.
Happy holidays!
Plus,
leaders at the COP30 climate summit in Brazil have agreed on a deal that ends the summit but fails to mention fossil fuels.
UN climate summit ends with sharp divide over phasing out fossil fuels.
All of those sad endings and more straight ahead from BrandBlog.com. I'm Brand Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We have allowed polluters to take over this process and make it ineffective. Why are we allowing the fossil fuel lobbyists to negotiate? It's like inviting arsonists to tell us how to put out the fire.
Well, they do know a lot about fire. Never mind. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, we have been gone for a week for Thanksgiving, so I'm hoping and praying you are able to come up with something to fill the next, oh, I don't know, 4.5 minutes or so.
I will try. Can't get to everything, but first, in Southeast Asia, a sequence of 4 ferocious simultaneous typhoons caused widespread devastation over the last week, one of the region's deadliest flood events in recent history. Fueled by record-warm Pacific Ocean waters, the powerful storms generated intense rains, catastrophic flooding, and landslides that buried entire villages and killed more than 1,000 people across Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Thailand, and Malaysia. Malaysia recorded its heaviest rainfall in at least 300 years.
Interesting that I heard so much news about those apartment fires in Hong Kong, and yet little to nothing about these storms with a much higher death rate.
Yep. And more than 1 million people have been displaced across Southeast Asia in need of food, water, shelter, and medicine. Much of the region is in monsoon season, but scientists say man-made global warming driven by the burning of fossil fuels is generating more extreme rain events and turbocharging storms across the planet. Speaking of fossil fuels, in the final days of the United Nations COP30 climate talks in Brazil, powerful petrostates and large polluting nations succeeded in blocking inclusion of a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels in the summit's concluding agreement. Because UN conferences operate by consensus, every word in any final text must be unanimously approved by all nations. The Trump administration did not send delegates to the talks. Climate activist Brandon Wu of Action Aid on Democracy Now! Slammed the obstructors.
The rich developed countries of the global north come in to these conferences and they act like they're the heroes, when in fact what they're doing is shifting the burden of a crisis that they caused onto the backs of the poor. Of course, we need a fossil fuel phase out. We need it as fast as possible. It has to start in the global north, and the global north has to provide the finance to the global south to enable that to happen.
Instead, host country Brazil launched an initiative with more than 85 countries to draw up that roadmap to phase out fossil fuels and set the world's first global fossil fuel phase out conference
on fire
for April 2026.
Oh.
Brazil also launched a new $125 billion funding vehicle to reduce rampant deforestation by paying developing countries to keep their forests intact. A new analysis warns that our overheating planet is causing forests and land to absorb 25% less carbon dioxide than they would without climate impacts, underscoring the necessity of halting forest losses. This year's Emissions Gap Report estimates that without faster reduction and climate warming emissions, the world will not be able to prevent global warming from overshooting 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. That's the main target of the Paris Agreement, and we are currently on track for a catastrophic 2.3 degrees Celsius or higher of warming. Here in the U.S., while much of the country was focused on the Thanksgiving holiday, the Trump administration was very busy working to ensure Americans could again enjoy more dirty air and contaminated water.
Thank God.
The Trump Environmental Protection Agency abandoned Biden-era air pollution rules that limit deadly soot pollution. Those are tiny particles that cause heart and lung disease and cause thousands of premature deaths in the U.S. The Trump White House exempted coal used in steel steelmaking, from Clean Air Act rules that limit toxic pollutants like mercury. The Trump EPA also proposed to illegally weaken new standards limiting PFAS forever chemicals in the nation's water supplies. And finally, the EPA announced that it is delaying a requirement for the oil and gas industry to limit their emissions of methane, a powerful planet-warming gas.
Well, why hurry? For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Yes, to love you. Des, so I jotted this down a few days ago. You know, last week we saw this horrific apartment building fire in Hong Kong. It received,
yes,
a lot of news coverage. Understandably, the death toll at the time that I had jotted this down was at least 151. It was the worst such fire in more than 75 years. And that made a lot of headlines last week, got a lot of coverage. And at the very same time, as mentioned there during our GNR, receiving seemingly much less news coverage is the fact that at least, 162 people at the time had, across multiple provinces in southern Thailand were killed by climate change-fueled flooding as these receding waters began to reveal this just devastation across the region. More than 1.2 million households, 3.6 million people were affected by the floods triggered by these heavy rains in 12 provinces, two different typhoons hitting them pretty much simultaneously. And that was just in one country affected by this, which folks may or may not have heard about. I suspect everyone has probably heard at least something about these non-climate related fires in Hong Kong. Why do you believe there was so little coverage of these storms with a far higher death toll as compared to the Hong Kong fires?
I think that's an excellent question.
Oh, thank
you. I don't exactly know why, but, you know, I can speculate that, you know, the U.S. media is famously biased against climate change coverage,
mm-hmm,
you know, fires create prettier video to look at. That's,
yeah,
probably more clickable. I'd also guess that perhaps, you know, something you and I have discussed, that, you know, climate change and climate change impacts, no matter how bad they get, they have become somewhat normalized.
Yeah.
That it's a kind of a ho-hum thing. Oh, yeah, climate change again, doing some destruction. Okay,
yep,
let's move on to something more interesting, like what crazy thing Trump said today.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know,
just another flood, just another massive hurricane, just another massive two hurricanes hitting at once.
Yeah.
No big deal.
I think it makes the U.S. media uncomfortable because they know that they need to be talking about this if they accept the science, but they're not.
Yep.
But all we right. are.
We are indeed. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is free because of folks like you who donate to our work by clicking on a button over there at bradblog.com or going straight to bradblog.com/donate. To help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog. You will find Desi at Green News Report. We will see you there. Until we see you here, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.